domestic violence during the pandemic. As the COVID-19 pandemic and its economic fallout continue, those committed to ending domestic violence are increasingly worried about people in abusive relationships. They believe domestic violence is surging behind closed doors. There are a number of reasons for this worry. People are isolated in their homes with the person who abuses them. Children are not going into schools where counselors and teachers may sense something is wrong. People aren't seeing their coworkers or friends whom they might confide in. And stress from financial challenges can often lead to violent behavior. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss ways in which people dealing with domestic violence can access support during the pandemic and how others can help. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For those who are dealing with domestic abuse, staying at home more because of the pandemic can be a truly hazardous situation. The likelihood of abuse is on the rise, and the options for seeking help are more limited. Today, we will learn about recognizing when there's a problem and how to find support. Joining me, Francine Garland Stark, who is Executive Director of the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, and Daryl Fort, board member of the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, whose focus is on gender violence prevention. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you dealt with domestic violence in the past? Are you concerned that someone in your life might need help? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you so much for being with us, both of you. And Francine, I guess the biggest question is, what do we know about whether or how much of a rise there has been in domestic violence since the onset of the pandemic?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the awful things about domestic abuse and violence is that it is invisible apart from that happens where people are able to call out for help. And so none of us have the real data to say this is how much there used to be and this is how much there is now. What I do know is how many calls we've gotten, and I know that the number of calls that we had in the last 3 months compared to that same period a year ago shows that the number of hotline calls we've received is up 20%. That doesn't mean we're serving more people, however. It means that we've had more urgent calls for assistance, and that assistance is needed in an urgent and in-depth way. The amount of time that we're spending helping people has increased by about 19%. So the other piece that we know is that we immediately started asking a question of the people that were calling us for help to try to get a sense of the impact of this period on them. And so we're able to ask 2,000 people over the course of the last 3 months just a few questions. And one of them that is very troubling is we asked them whether or not they had elevated safety concerns because of the COVID-19 circumstances. And 72% of that 2,084 people said yes, they had elevated concerns. So we really know that this is making things much harder for people. But the encouraging piece was that 97% of the people we surveyed said that we were able to meet their needs in the course of that interaction, even though we couldn't meet face-to-face. So calling the hotline was really helpful to them, and we were able to engage with things that helped address some of their pressing needs.
Daryl, I'll turn to you to ask the question, why? Why elevated safety concerns? What does the pandemic do to change the situation?
Well, I think one of the things it does is it restricts. We're restricted in our movement. And so our victims' ability to to be in a different place, to have the schedule that takes them away from their abuser, that gives them an opportunity to be around a support system if they have them, are limited. And then conversely, those that are abusive have their victims in a more captive space and have a greater ability to abuse and control.
Francine, are there certain demographics most affected? Is there a typical abuser or person being abused?
Well, that's a complicated question. No is sort of the short answer. The disproportionality is around most of the people who are perpetrating domestic abuse and violence are men. Most of the people who are experiencing domestic abuse and violence are women. Within that, if a woman is a woman of color, if a woman is indigenous, if a woman is of any community that is marginalized within our society, they are at much greater risk for harm. So we pay particular attention to trying to do that kind of outreach in order to try to better reach those marginalized populations. But people who are at the most risk in a general sense are, in fact, women.
And Francine, isn't that a big challenge right now, reaching the people that you want to reach? I know that there are so many programs in Maine. I'm thinking of the one that gets hairstylists trained and looking for signs, and maybe fewer people are going to their hairstylist, fewer people going to the workplace. Is it more difficult for you to do the outreach you need to do?
It's always really hard to do the outreach, and it is, of course, hard now. And in some ways, though, I think people are way more conscientious of what's happening in social media right now. I know all of our member programs and our coalition have really increased our presence in social media of various kinds to try to get an array of messages out, because there's been a lot of misinformation as well. Because people had this sense that, you know, the services are not available, but in fact they are. And we're helping people in very much the same ways we were before. We are very much sheltering people. We have more shelter bed nights than we had prior to COVID because people are staying longer. And we have way more people in motels than we've ever had historically. So we've really been trying to use social media especially. But always the most powerful referrals that we hear are that when people get in touch with us, they say, I'm calling because my friend encouraged me to call. My boss encouraged me to call. My clergy encouraged me to call. So I always want to get the message out there that the most important and effective outreach is everyone out there who's concerned about someone reaching out and encouraging them to make that contact. That is the most effective outreach, person to person.
How do you know, Francine, when to be concerned about someone? I mean, I'm sure obviously if somebody has bruises, but what are some other things, some other signs that we all need to be aware of?
I think most of the time we're not going to see bruises. I think most of the time what we're going to experience is a change in behavior. Someone who's a victim of abuse often will really have some changes in how they interact with people that are remarkable. Like they used to be somebody at work who would engage with coworkers and you notice over the course of time that they've pulled back. They tend not to join with coworkers in any kind of outside of work conversation, and they tend to get quite reticent. You also may notice that they're getting just a lot of texts and calls from their partner, and they're immediately responsive to that. It takes them away from everything. It's as if, you know, it's sort of that their partner has become really their very central focus rather than anything else. You may become aware that they were really excited about pursuing their education and they're considering dropping out, that they used to be have a job and be working and suddenly they've decided, well, they can't really work now. It's more important for them to focus on their family, but they don't actually seem really excited about that. So it's really about behavioral cues that give an indication that in their partnership, they're beginning to let go of a bunch of things that used to be important and valuable to them, which gives us a sign that their partner is having a coercive and controlling impact on their decision making and their sense of themselves and their intentions.
Daryl, we mentioned at the top of the program that your focus is on gender violence prevention. Why is it so important that men talk to men about this?
Well, I think, Jennifer, one of the ways is there's a flip side, if you will, to part of what Francine just described, and that is, so we're friends, we're colleagues, we're peers, we're in supervisory roles, or what have you, around the people who are perpetrating the abuse that Francine just described. And so, our attentiveness to the dynamics of those relationships are important as well. And I think the part of the thinking behind it is abusers exist in a broad context. Like they're around us, right? And either they feel in many ways a sort of pressure to not abuse, or they feel a sense of sort of tacit approval around their behavior. So some of the flip side of, say, the texts or the phone calls that somebody who may feel like be the victim of abuse, the flip side of that is if somebody that's doing that. And there are times when that person's doing that around other people. Or you pay attention to the way somebody's talking about their partner and sort of derisive, sarcastic, angry, constantly putting them down, things of that nature. And I think, the important element around that is to sort of not necessarily just brush that off. There are a lot of ways, I think, in relationships when we're concerned about what's going on with somebody, that we figure out a way to broach that with them. And I don't think that's any different in this situation, but for the fact that I think many of us in this culture were taught that this type of behavior is none of our business, or you don't quite know what to say, or it becomes a, quote, can of worms that you don't want to open up, or you don't want to risk yourself being the subject of this person's anger, or you don't want to jeopardize a friendship. There are all of these things that I think people recognize as fears, but I think there's a way so we can look at this, and this is just one angle, right? I think there are many, but there's one angle you can look at this at is to say, look, if this is somebody that's in your life, dependent on your relationship with them, if you care about this person, then you owe it to them as well to start asking questions about what's going on. And maybe even come at it from a perspective of your concern about what you see in their behavior.
Yeah, I was going to say, give us some advice. You hear someone talking sarcastically, derisively about their partner. Give us some words. What do you say?
So it depends, right? So your relationship with a person obviously matters. You speak in your own voice, one that you feel like is appropriate and comfortable for the relationship. But for somebody, for example, I'm in a relationship with, is like, hey, man, like, that didn't sound very nice. What's going on? And what you may get back is something derisive towards their partner, in which case, you might question whether or not, I don't know, man. I'm not sure that's the best way to go about it. Or I don't know if that's the best way for you to move ahead in a more responsive or a healthy way in your relationship, or simply, hey, that's not a good look, man. You should figure out a different way. Or that makes me uncomfortable when you talk like that.
Francine, we've put the Domestic Violence Helpline on our Facebook page and our web page, but I want to talk to you about calling that, making a decision if somebody's in a position where they're trying to decide whether to leave, whether to call the helpline, whether to call the police. If someone is feeling in danger right now, today, What advice do you have for that person?
I think people should take the step that feels the most comfortable to them. One of the things about calling our hotline is that it's confidential, it's free, the people are trained to understand and listen, and we don't have any agenda for you, and we're not going to take any action that you haven't consented to. And so we're really about calling a well-informed colleague to collaborate and help strategize what can happen to help you be safe. But if you're feeling absolutely in danger and somebody's committed a crime against you, you should call the police. And if that is a thing that feels safe to you, not everybody does. Most people don't call the police until something has happened many times to them and they've given up any possibility that they're going to be able to be safe from this person without somebody stepping in who's more powerful and has more ability to intervene than all the things you've tried. So the police can be an important intervention, but most of the time, people find their way to be free and safe from this using whatever things feel like they're going to be the most effective for them. So this isn't a you should do this. It's about we offer the opportunity to talk to experts in this field to consult and come up with what kind of strategies might be the safest for you. And that might include the police. It might not. It might include a protection order. It might include some other quite practical steps that you can take. And I also want to emphasize that we help people regardless of where they're at in their process, and not everyone is able to or ever actually leaves a partner. And lots of the people we help have left long ago, but they're still coping with the fact that abuse is caused by the abuser's belief that they can do what they're doing and their intention to continue to have control over this person. And it doesn't end until they choose to stop doing that. And so many people have been apart from an abusive partner for many years, but they're calling us for help because that abuse has continued to be problematic. It's problematic for them and often for their children. So,
all right. This is I'm looking right now, Francine, at a map from your organization, and it shows that there are places all over the state that are part of the coalition. I'm looking in far northern Aroostook County, down east Maine, central Maine, southern Maine, and I'll say the number on the air, 1-866-834-4357. We're talking about domestic violence during COVID-19 on Maine Calling. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'd love to have your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood's My Fish Dish, lemon and herb butter North Atlantic scallops, and three other varieties found in the freezer at your local Hannaford. And Maine Academy of Natural Sciences, a charter school focused on agriculture, forestry, and the environment. MeansAcademy.org.
A new comet is passing by Earth, and it's visible to much of the Northern Hemisphere.
You know, in spite of the really difficult times right now, it's really a reminder that we're part of a bigger universe, and there are some really wonderful and beautiful things in it.
More on the comet Neowise this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today, starting at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
So what makes Maine really special, and this is something that I've learned throughout me being from Brunswick, but then going to Bowdoin, where we have these different people coming from all different backgrounds, but still within Brunswick, is that Mainers, you talk about Southern hospitality, but really you have Maine hospitality, where we're just so ready to help other people. We have this huge resource, we're over 89% forest. We have Katahdin Waters within Baxter State Park. We have Acadia, we have Tumbledown, we have Camden, we have Rockport, we have all of this ocean coastline. To me, it means access. My name is Sean Baird, I'm from Brunswick, Maine, and this is my Maine.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to MainePublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, understanding how domestic violence occurs and what to do about it and how that might be worsened during COVID-19. Joining me, two leaders in this field, both with the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, Executive Director Francine Garland-Stark and Board President Daryl Fort. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Patricia McLean. She is a professional photographer, founder and president of Finding Our Voices. She was married to singer Don McLean, who is charged with domestic violence. Thanks so much for joining us, Patricia.
Thank you for having me on the show, and thank you for doing this show.
Tell us what the focus of Finding Our Voices is.
Finding Our Voices is breaking the silence of domestic partner abuse, town by town, conversation by conversation, all over Maine.
I understand you're involved with a big push to increase awareness. Tell us what's happening right now.
Well, the latest thing is that the Camden National Bank has just come on as the lead sponsor of our downtown window banner campaign, which is really exciting because we launched this April 1st in the Midcoast. But with this sponsorship, we're going to be able to take it all across the state. And it's banners. They're 4 foot by 2 foot. So they're big and they're bold. And they're in downtown business windows. They stay up for a month. They go town to town. And each one has a portrait of one of, we're up to 27 now, one of 27 domestic abuse survivors from all over Maine, aged 18, Sydney to Mary Lou, who's 80. Plus the hotline number for the local domestic abuse agency. And they are now in about a dozen towns and going to another dozen in a few weeks. And I did hear earlier on the show, yes, it is very important to reach out to the domestic abuse agency. And that's a big part of what we do is we, with the banners, we encourage people to make that call because a lot of women don't think of themselves as victims. They just, even when they're in the worst kind of abuse, they just don't think of themselves as domestic abuse victims. And so part of what the banners does also is it's all about awareness. Like it lets people realize this is complex and, you know, how many people it affects. And because there's a quote on each banner also. So the quotes give it, show the complexity of it and all the different permutations.
Patricia, before we let you go, what do you want to tell people who may be experiencing domestic abuse?
You're not alone. And others have, a lot of people have gotten out and you can get out too. You can get safely out. And if I could just say one thing that I would advise for people who know people who are going through this and may be frustrated because the person is not leaving, the best thing is just don't judge them. Just let them know that you're there for them. And then when they're ready to leave, they'll know who they can call you, and that could be a lifeline.
Thank you so much. That was Patricia McLean, who is founder and president of Finding Our Voices. Before we go on to other calls, Francine, I wanted to ask you about children. We've been really speaking a lot about partners or husbands or wives in this situation, but what do you expect is the corollary right now with abuse of children?
Well, it's incredibly, it's the thing that keeps me up at night for sure, because I think children who are living in homes where they're being abused directly or there's abuse against their parent are so disempowered in this time where they have so little access to anyone outside their household. And so this is a time when the role of extended family or anyone who is having any kind of direct access to a family is so incredibly important. Children need to have a voice, and often children finding their voice is a result of of really concerned outsiders being able to be aware of what's going on and make reports to Child Protective Services where that is warranted because of a concern of jeopardy, or to be able to reach out to the person who seems to be the protective parent in order to offer some kind of support and intervention.
Mm. All right. We've got another call now. We've got a call from Fatuma Hussein. Fatuma, whose voice is probably familiar to many of you, is the founder of the Immigrant Resource Center of Maine, which is based in the Lewiston-Auburn area. Hi, Fatuma.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, my colleagues from Sun and
Hey, it is so nice to hear your voice, Fatuma. I'm wondering if you, I know you've done this work for a long time, do you worry that domestic violence is on the rise in the immigrant communities in Maine?
Absolutely. It's important to note that immigrant women who are survivors of domestic violence often are invisible. A lot of data doesn't reflect who we are. A lot of our voices are not heard. That said, we've always been fleeing from violence. We've always been running away from violence. And so violence is what we know. Violence is what we live in. And so, yes, just in the last 3 days or 4 days, just quite a bit of uptick on referrals from the police department in terms of services. The good thing is a lot of us have done quite a bit of good work to ensure that people know what services exist, regardless of what language you speak and regardless of what cultural background you come from.
All right. And I know that many people are coming from places that have a different cultural expectation of the role of men and women. And you've done a lot of work about letting people know what the laws are here in the United States. How effective do you think the work has been at getting through to most of the people in the communities you work with?
It was difficult initially. When we started this work back in 2004, it was a taboo to talk about domestic violence. We were fearful of going on the streets. From the beginning, our work really engaged community prevention, and our partners were men. Our partners were faith leaders, whether it was Christian churches that were African-led or the mosque. And so we did quite a bit of work. And today, people just wander into our office. They call the police, you know, referrers, hospitals refer. There's quite a bit of high level of awareness, but that didn't come easily. It came with a lot of work, because when we came into this work, not only were we changing a custom and a taboo of domestic violence in the communities that we serve, but we were also working within a system that was not necessarily prepared for us. And so we had to simultaneously work between the two, the community and the system, to engage everybody. And so today we speak at mosque. You know, on a Friday prayer, we come on the microphone. Obviously, a lot of men there and saying, okay, it's a Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we need you to really get your acts together and do this and do this, and here are the services. Very, very, in fact, our signature program is, we are a dual program, so we do both domestic violence and sexual assault. That is our signature program. That's what we are known for. Although we are an advocacy program and we do a lot of different things, what we're known for is gender-based violence.
I wanted to ask you about the specifics of the economic stress of this time. On Maine Calling, we were talking just a couple weeks ago about how many of the immigrants in Maine are the frontline essential workers, how stressful their jobs are, how stressful it is for people who have lost their jobs right now. And if you worry that this economic stress has increased the risk of domestic violence in the immigrant community.
Absolutely. Well, the stress is always an increase in anything. And so, as you well stated, we are the essential workers of the state of Maine. When COVID hit, people who had protections were able to stay home, were able to do other things with their employers. We didn't have that chance. We didn't have that opportunity. And that's all people of color in the state of Maine. And so we were working around the clock. We were people of color taking care of white people. And so that has really increased our level of stress. And that's why we were so surprised seeing all these different referrals, which is very unusual for us. That really pinpoints at the elevated level of stress and fear and what's going on in the home. And so we've done quite a bit of outreach. We go into homes. We are embedded in the communities that we serve. We live side by side with our communities. We go to the same grocery stores. So we've done just quite a bit of, a lot of elevation of education through Zoom calls, through WhatsApp groups, through chats, making sure that people have access to services and knowing what number to call at any time of the day or the night.
All right. And before we let you go, Fatuma, how can people access help? How can immigrants who feel as though they're in an unsafe situation find you or find others who will help?
Please call 207-753-0061. Again, 207-753-0061. The thing about us is the people who are providing, the advocates who are providing these services, don't have any cultural difference and any language difference, meaning our advocates and providers are coming from the communities that we serve. And that has made it much, much easier for us to build trust.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. That's Fatuma Hussein, the founder of the Immigrant Resource Center of Maine, which is based in the Lewiston, Auburn area. We're going to go from Fatuma's call to Joe, who's calling from Robertson. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually calling to speak a little bit about something a little different. As a male, I've been in situations where I've been in relationships and somebody's been really aggressive, and I've had relatives that the same thing and friends who the same thing. And if the story seems similar, a lot of times in a man's case, he seems perfectly fine, he's normal, this and that. And somebody else talked about that earlier, noticing the signs, but you won't see a man who's, you know, getting yelled at and confrontations at home and kind of wondering what's going on. But I have heard people say, if you're a man, be careful, because it could be just one of those days you come from work and your boss has been rude and disrespectful or something's happened, and you can respond the wrong way in those situations and the cops can be called. So it's not always the female who's a victim, and it's not always the female you're looking for the signs from. It could be a man, and he could just say, well, I don't physically feel threatened, but the verbal stuff and all the, you know, somebody's taunting you and stuff like that, you could be dismissing it in your mind, but that one day is just the wrong day. Just like it could just be another male. Men might feel, hey, you know, no problem, I'm not a physical person, but that same person, the wrong day, could end up doing something that they just wouldn't do because they've been dealing with it so long. So you don't often see the signs in men, and they try to dismiss it in their mind, but it does build up. It's like a boiling pot, and you got to be really careful if you're a male that you're talking about it and you're getting out there and addressing it so it doesn't go that way. And sometimes it is best to walk away, and I know people want relationships to last, but sometimes you trying to make it work when you have that kind of aggression coming from somebody who maybe came from an abusive
right.
family, and they saw that with their parents, that's the way they naturally react too.
I want to pass this to Daryl Fort, who's with us right now. Daryl, your thoughts on what Joe's saying?
Yeah, so one of the things that comes to mind is one of the things the caller said, I can't remember his name, but having a, if you're a man in that situation, being prepared to have the mental conversation, the internal conversation about, you know, what's this next move that I'm going to make? Like, what are the consequences, possibly about my behavior right now? You know, one of the things we need to examine sort of in the culture in terms of how, you know, we raise men to resolve conflict is that the sense that we've got sort of that ultimate argument decider, and the ultimate argument decider is the threat or the use of physical violence of some kind, and making a choice that that's just not a choice that you would ever want to make. And I think the other thing that was mentioned by the caller is, you know, the ability to walk away. And that's in any instance where you feel like the situation, you have the ability and you feel like the situation may be escalating in a way that you're in physical danger or you're about to harm somebody physically, is to walk away from the situation. Seek a support system of your own.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you so much for your call. We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about domestic violence. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Marshall Communications. With its new ebook, 10 Tips for How Your Small Business Can Beat COVID-19 with Empathy and Action, MarshallPR.com. And Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions, Encore.eco. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Gorham, Maine-born author and American Christian innovator Ellen Gould White passed away on July 16, 1915. Along with other Adventist leaders such as Joseph Bates and her husband James White, she was instrumental within a small group of early Adventists who formed what became known as the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The Smithsonian Magazine named White among the 100 most significant Americans of all time. During her lifetime, she wrote more than 5,000 periodical articles and 40 books. White's writings still influence people today.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine! The Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is on a twice-a-week schedule, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On these 2 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is normally scheduled for Tuesday and Thursdays each week and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're discussing ways to recognize and prevent domestic abuse and learning about help and support here in Maine. My guests are Daryl Fort and Francine Garland Stark with the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to read an email from Mimi. She writes, "Verbal abuse is extremely toxic and always has the implicit or even explicit threat of escalating to the physical. Verbal abuse is destructive to the soul and invisible to the rest of the world. Breaking someone else's possessions conveys the message that, quote, I can easily do this to you. I heartily recommend the book, Why Does He Do That? By Lundy Bancroft." Francine, what do you think of Mimi's connection between verbal abuse and physical abuse?
I appreciate her comment and the book recommendation. It's a very good book. I think one of the things that is hard for people to get their understanding around is that when we're talking about domestic abuse and violence, we're talking about a pattern of behavior that involves a whole array of tactics. Where you see verbal abuse, you're also probably seeing someone who's using isolation and threats and minimization. I mean, verbal abuse is sort of a catch-all term for a whole bunch of things that people do by talking that are actually threatening and demeaning and minimizing what's happened in the circumstance. And that's what is the characteristic of what is domestic abuse. It's this ongoing pattern of behavior, most of which is, in fact, verbal. And from time to time, there's physical violence or sexual violence, and sometimes that is severe. But that, but those are not isolated incidents. They're part of this ongoing behavior that puts the abusive partner in a position of power over the other, and that other person feels afraid and diminished and boxed in. And so, like Patricia was saying earlier, it's really hard when you're in that place to feel like there's any hope of ever being able to break free from that. And so it's really helpful to be able to reach out and get the opportunity to talk with someone who can help you get some different perspective and explore potential options in order to be able to break out of that sense of trap and hopelessness. And at the same time, within our community, our focus has been so extensively on what can victims of abuse do to get away that we haven't given enough attention to the kinds of things Daryl was just talking about so brilliantly, which is how do we reach out to people who may be acting violently, whether they feel like they have some justification for that or not. What is it that's right? How do we see what's right relationship with each other? And how do we intervene with that, whether we think someone's being abusive and inappropriate or whether we think someone is being the victim?
Daryl, what do you want to add to that?
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to go back to, something that Francine just mentioned about a victim in particular feeling sort of boxed in and not feeling like they have anywhere to go, is the way in which the people around them can participate in that. So in other words, oftentimes in my work, I'll talk about the fact that none of us who are bystanders to this are occupying any neutral space. So in other words, we're always making decisions, making choices about how we react to these circumstances, whether we like it or not. The things that we say are giving signals to both victims and perpetrators in these dynamics about the type of people we are, either safe to approach as support or resources, or a space where I'm not going to be believed, or I'm going to have this behavior minimized if I'm a victim, or if I'm a perpetrator of this behavior, it's something where nobody's going to check me on this. Right? People are afraid to address this. My boss is afraid to address this. My colleagues are afraid to say anything to me. My friends and family, they're not going to bother. And that's often the tool in the toolbox of an abuser that they'll use against victims as well. But one of the things that's attended to that that I want to talk a little bit about here, it is the external mechanisms and institutions and organizations' responsibility around this issue. So one of the projects years ago when I worked in state government in the Baldacci administration, Francine and I and a number of others colleagues worked on a project that directed state agencies to develop domestic and sexual abuse policies within each state agency. And part of what that did was just establish a baseline that everybody in the organization understands. Like, this is what we will tolerate as an organization. This is what we won't tolerate. This is how we will support you in terms of your time, in terms of a whole host of different sort of areas. If you are the victim, and an example of that is you've had to take time off to get protected from abuse order, our organizational policy is that we're going to allow you to do something like that. But we create spaces. We create the culture in our spaces and our organizations, right, that deliver really solid messages to and provide actual concrete support or consequences as it relates to domestic and relationship violence in it. And I think it's part of if people who are listening to feel like they're sort of outside of this issue in some way, they're not quite sure what to do. If you're a leader in an organization, that's absolutely a concrete thing that you can do, sort of look inside of your own policies and examine whether or not, what are we saying about this issue to our employees, to our members, et cetera. And how can we do that in a better way.
I'm going to go to Stephen calling from Portland. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. What a timely topic. That wasn't really my name, but for purposes of anonymity, I've been in recovery for 27 years. And many times I've heard at meetings terrible tales of how people under the influence of alcohol would go and do things they would never dream of doing when they were sober. It's a progressive, potentially fatal disease that may start off fun, but over time gets worse and worse and gets to the point where the alcoholic can no longer not drink. And being in a COVID situation where people are not getting the flexibility of going outside like they normally used to exacerbates the other person being right there all the time and getting on your nerves and lacking the coping skills. There's a temptation to react and harm the other individual verbally or physically that otherwise wouldn't manifest. Now, there are things that can be done besides the things that have been mentioned so far. There's Alcoholics Anonymous for those who wish to consider stopping drinking. You don't have to do anything more than just show up at an open meeting. There are Zoom meetings, online phone meetings. Call the Central Service Office in Portland. I'm happy to get you started. There's also Al-Anon for people who have loved ones who have a trouble with alcohol. There are millions of people who have been down this path.
Stephen, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. And Francine, I wonder what your reaction is to Stephen and also the sort of realization here that so many issues are interrelated.
Well, things are interrelated. And I think one of the things that's so important is to not confuse co-occurrence with causality. And I think that, as Stephen said, that there are sometimes people do unfortunate things that are isolated incidents that are a lot of the things he's talking about. And I certainly agree that these are times in which, especially people who have addictions, alcoholism, are in a place where they need help and supports more than ever. What we find in our work is that substance use disorders are sometimes present, but in fact they are not the cause of this ongoing pattern of abusive behavior. It's not a person's addiction that informs whether or not they interrupt their partner's ability to stay in touch with their family or keep their job. The intentionality behind the behavior of people who are engaged in domestic abuse and violence is an additional issue in that person's life. Their belief about what's okay to do, whether or not one of the things about domestic abuse and violence is that it's the way that perpetrators of domestic abuse behave is based on their beliefs about how they can treat this person because they are their partner. What they think about that, what they feel entitled to do in that context. And so there, it's important to address all of the struggles that people have as those unique struggles. If we only address a person's addiction and we don't also address their belief system around how they believe they're entitled to treat their partner, we won't have solved the problem of domestic abuse. Unless what happened was an isolated incident of assault, which was connected to that, which sometimes happens, but it is not the characteristic of what most people are perpetrating or experiencing in the context of this ongoing pattern of coercive controlling behavior.
Stephen, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to go to Lawton.
Jennifer?
Go ahead, Daryl.
Yeah, Jeff, I mean, just briefly, I mean, Francine just articulated this. I think it's just worth reinforcing in relation to that last call. You know, if the help you are seeking in some form or fashion isn't helping you confront your belief system or your sense of entitlement around dominating, abusing, and perpetrating violence against your partner in the context of your addiction, then you're not getting the help that you need around your abuse.
I'm going to go to Lawton calling from Penobscot. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to mention the ACE study which is adverse childhood experience study that's been ongoing now for about 30 years with the Center for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente. But they now have interviewed over, I think, several hundred thousand people about abuse from their childhood and those long-term effects. And what we know now in science and medicine is that we can correlate certain disease states, certain connective tissue and autoimmune disorders and cancers with high correlations of abuse and trauma. And so
sure, Lawton, we're getting toward the end of the program, so I want Francine to have a chance to respond. But ACEs is sort of, Francine, what we've been talking about really for generations, even before we were talking about ACEs, these cycles of violence and other problems.
Well, I think that the bottom line is what adverse childhood experiences teaches us is how vitally important it is for us to do everything we can as a community to ensure that all children are loved and have the opportunity for a stable, thriving environment so that they can go on to be the best that they can. And those of us who are in a position to intervene are all of us, some of us in a formal place and some of us as the bystander, the person who's present. So the good news is that there's something for all of us to do every day in the things that we tolerate, the things that we do ourselves, the things that we welcome, the things that we challenge, because we're always building the culture in which all of us live. And so if we value children and we value the adults they will become, we really have to pay attention to ourselves and the systems in which we function with that large picture and those lofty goals in mind.
All right, Daryl, just a few seconds to wrap it up.
Amen to that.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for being here with us. The voices you just heard, Francine Garland Stark, the executive director of the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, and board president Daryl Fort. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. You can find past editions as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay with us for the latest update from CDC Director Nirav Shah. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on Maine Public Radio. You can also watch the briefing on Maine Public Television or at the Maine Public website. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.